Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hello and welcome to the Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is Professor Emeritus at the U.S. Naval Academy, author of a biography of Admiral Nimitz, and most recently, Annapolis Goes to War, many other phenomenal books, Craig Simmons. And remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com. For next week's show, we'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, ZBiotics, Miracle Made, and Trust and Will, in our show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. James, Donald Trump the top cop of the world has, at least for now, decided to take control of Washington, D.C.'s law enforcement. This is neither about tackling crime or worried about D.C. It's two purposes. One is a distraction from the Epstein scandal, at least in the media for now. That seems to be working. The other is to draw Democrats into a fight over crime along with immigration instead of battling over Medicaid cuts or food prices. In Washington, the crime rate is down sharply from a few years ago. Trump lied about that. But if that becomes the centerpiece of any Democratic criticism, they lose, Trump wins. Crime still is too high, and anyone who gets carjacked or mugged thinks it's off the charts. You can go after Trump on several grounds. One, he doesn't care about crime. Remember January the 6th? He sat idly by as the Capitol was assaulted and people died. He didn't call out the National Guard then. He just does it for political purposes. The other is that I think we do need more police in some of our big cities, including Washington. But the National Guard, the Park Police, and others, they are not trained for this. They are trained sometimes to help with crowd control. We need more police. What he ought to do, and better paid police, what he ought to do is take that huge increase from the awful big bill for ICE of $75 billion, you know, take 10% of that and give it to cities to be used to add additional police forces if necessary. You know, as our guest, remember our guest, David Harris from the University of Pittsburgh Law School, who notes that if you flood the zone, police flood the zone with good cops in high crime areas, it reduces crime, it protects people. It's the effective way to go about this. Trump doesn't give a damn about this. This is just all for a show.
Okay, so what she said is certainly what we hear. And we hear that it's crime and there's the perception that Democrats are solving crime, and we shouldn't talk about that. Okay, I understand that. Just so we know what the facts are, the crime rate in 2024, the last year of the Biden administration, okay, I could say the first year, you heard something. By year four, you're willing to call it time, was the lowest it had been since 1960. Let me repeat that, okay? In the year 2024, the crime rate in the United States was the lowest it's been since 1960. So, of course, people don't know that. The perception is it's high. And the question then becomes, well, do we just not talk about it? So I think that in the most precipitous drop in crime came in the 1990s. Understand, going into the 90s, it was thought we had a predator class. It this was universally accepted from academia on down. Of course, we had no such thing. And we end up in 2024 with the lowest crime rate since 1960. And understand, particularly things like shootings, these are very accurate statistics. All right, I'm sorry. So the question is do we talk about other things? Well, I'm not sure that 65 years of talking about other things has served the country very well. And I know, and people fail, we friends of ours on our Sunday Zoom, in the word that gets you every time is the perception. Well, how did the perception get there? Because it certainly didn't get there because people were experiencing more crime. I know one crime is too many, but it's kind of across the board. The whole thing went like crazy down. I mean, like way outside of any statistical noise or margin of error or anything like that. And the crime rate in Washington, D.C. was down 26%. But if somebody says, but that's not what people think, well, maybe they think that because they've been told it's high and people say, well, we shouldn't point out because we just let it go. I don't know. But I do know that this is what we faced with, and I'm just not, you know, certainly that we can talk about rural hospitals, which was, you know, a big issue with people. You know, maybe crime is not a big issue it used to be, for the simple reason there's less crime. Okay, that's why it's not as issue as it used to be. But if they're gonna go, if we're gonna go on the perception there's more crime, I don't know, Al. I'm thinking out loud. I mean, this is a conversation that's not going to get solved on one podcast. It's not going to get solved on one Zoom call. But I do know, and I hear this repeatedly, the perception is crime is high and it's the Democrats' fault in the cities. And that's just not true.
Well, it's not true. And I certainly am not saying don't talk about crime. Talk about crime. Talk about real crime prevention. Talk about more cops. Talk about the fact that Washington has 1,000 less police officers than it did a year ago. Talk about the fact that the Republicans in Congress are holding up something like $1 billion of funding that goes to law enforcement, among other things. And talk about the fact the National Guard and the Park Police, as Trump would have you believe, are not trained to deal with inner city policing. They're trained to deal with crowd control in some cases. And I think talk about the fact that police efforts ought to be focused on those areas of high crime. And I think that A is substantively correct, and I think it's politically correct. To argue crime is down, it is. But I mean, I'm sorry, it's not for that person who was mugged. It's not for that person whose car was taken. It's not for, I mean, it is, I forget the statistics, but something like, you know, 100 out of every 10,000. But it's not that you give in to his line on this. You don't. You attack his line, but you don't talk about it as if, well, let's just let it happen, whatever's going on.
And yeah, just maybe I'm open. I understand. Okay. But maybe if you started, what are we doing that is working and how do we build on that? And I know if one person's mugged, the statistic doesn't matter. If a guy loses his job, the rate of employment doesn't matter. If somebody puts their money in some shitty startup and they lose money, well, the S&P doesn't matter to them. But I'm just asking, should we, like, what in the fuck are you talking about? All right. And all we have to do, I'm sorry, is, you know, we could go back to what's working. Policing is actually working well in the country today. all right, this is something I do know something about, and it's working because, well, it's something they call predictive policing, and it's pretty damn successful. And what is working, you know, there are a lot of factors that go into crime reduction, but effective policing is certainly one of them. And why don't we go back and do it 100,000 cops, as opposed to tax breaks for people making over $500,000 a year.
Amen. And, amen. Well, amen.
This is what's working. Let's do more of what's working. But start from the premise like, well, we're having some success here. After 4 years, Joe Biden with the lowest in 65 fucking years. All right. I'm saying the approach is critical. I believe what I'm arguing, but it's something that has to be flushed out because it's always, I go back and the frustration that I feel, you know, when you take a poll, who's better in the economy, Republicans or Democrats, Republicans kind of come out better. Well, that's the perception. So we really shouldn't say, and I'm not directing this at you, that actually by every macroeconomic performance that we can think of, we're at Larry Summers on the show and we asked him, and he said, well, it's kind of true, tell you the truth. Why is it that Democrats beat Republicans on every positive economic indicator that exists? The only one that is kind of even is inflation, but that's understandable. But why people don't know that? Is it the fault of Fox that doesn't tell them that? I'm sure it has something to do with it. Is it the fault of Democratic messaging and Democratic people say, wait a minute, stop, get away we are. And they say, well, you shouldn't say it. And I understand that too, because if the economy is not good for one person and you say it's good, they think you're clueless. But somehow or another, the American public is getting really shitty information. And I don't know I don't know if it's whose fault it is, but some of it is, we better not talk about it.
Well, I think we ought to talk about it, but I think we ought to talk about it in a way that's both substantively and politically effective. It is very easy to criticize what Trump is doing. I'm sorry, the Park Police are not going to be your great protectors if you're down on Georgia Avenue in Washington. They don't know how to do police work in the city. They haven't been trained that way. Same in the National Guard. I think you can say the police force in Washington is down, I think, by about 1,000. And I think they need more police. They need more police in designated areas and could keep doing the kind of police work they're doing. But, James, they also need more money. Congress, the Republicans are withholding $1 billion. You know, part of the problem is school truancy and lack of summer opportunities. Those kids who took on the former Doge guy and assaulted him were 15 years old. And I think there can be, you know, more money for that, too. But basically, I think you're right. Basically, we're doing a good job in most places on crime. And let's just build on that.
It's a matter of, this is, just think of, we're down 26%. Just think of what we would be if we were, manpower's 1,000 short. So you say, well, you know, whatever, we're going to get to 1,000. Police recruiting, for a lot of reasons, is hard. You know what one of the big reasons is? Drug testing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm being frank with you. All right.
Yeah.
And it's also poaching. So the Metropolitan Police, I forgot this. It's like an astronomical number of police forces in the Washington, D.C. area that can actually make an arrest. It's like 25 or maybe more than that. So they're recruiting against the Park Police, the Bearport Police, the Capitol Police, the George Washington Parkway Police, the Pentagon Police, the you name it. I mean, it's hard for the D.C., the Metropolitan Police Force, to hire people because there's a lot of pressure to get police jobs. And, you know, maybe we could do something, but just from the vantage point of, it's working really well. How do we keep this ball rolling in the right direction? How do we build on the momentum we have? And that's all I'm saying directionally. That's what we got to go to. And of course, they can't argue. I mean, they're going to argue with it, and they're not going to tell their people. But, you know, you just say, look, you can fact check. I mean, this is just what it is. And again, some of these crime statistics should be really accurate. Like shootings is particularly accurate because the hospitals have to report when somebody gets nicked, you don't know it. But there's something that's going on. And it's something that's happening that's pretty good. And the better we figure it out, and I think we both kind of feel like at some level, more effective policing really works.
I do. And I think, but again, the term more is there. I think in a place like Washington, you need more police doing the good kind of police work that they're capable of doing. That's in contrast to Trump. Trump is talking about National Guards and Park Police and everything. That does not work. And I think it's very easy to criticize Trump and also have a plan to make what has been an improved situation better.
All right. So read the Declaration of Independence. And read the beef that they had about British having troops on our streets. I think there's even a provision in the Constitution. I got to check, but we got a lot of lawyers here that talks about quartering troops. Somebody pointed out that during the World War II, the Japanese had captured a couple of islands in the Aleutians, and the troops came in, and actually somebody might have had a case that they would confiscate people's houses. I mean, there were 200 people that lived there, but it doesn't matter. It's the United States. So, but the whole idea of domestic troops is really inbred in the tradition of the United States as manifested in its Declaration of Independence. So this is grotesquely anti-patriotic. We're turning our backs on the principles that this country was founded on. We're turning our backs on what's in the Declaration of Independence. And I unfortunately can't pull it up fast enough, but I think even there's something in the Constitution about it.
Well, we can check that. And I would just add that those, you know, terrific young men and women graduating from West Point and Annapolis are not trained to hunt down bicycle stealers. We need good cops. And I think we have a lot of good cops. We can have, in some areas, we probably need more. I go back to, as I say, our friend David Harris, who I think enumerated exactly what works so well. So we'll come back to this. The other Trump news, I'm starting to laugh. He didn't like the numbers that came out from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. A bunch of professionals over there who put together reliable numbers. They've been relied on for decades, if not longer. But Trump had a very simple solution. He fired the director of the BLS, highly respected woman, apparently, and he replaced her with a Trump lackey, E.J. Antoni. Now, you know, the data reported by the BLS, James, it matters. The Federal Reserve bases much of its decision-making on what kind of data they're seeing, reliable data they're seeing from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Social Security benefits are determined by the BLS's consumer price index changes. And I'm not sure how much this new guy can fool with the data, but there is he has a clear mandate from Trump. Get me good numbers. It's gonna be really interesting to watch, and I'm gonna be skeptical he starts producing good numbers.
Well, as our dear friend Roger Altman points out, there's a wealth of private data out there. And then, of course, the markets pay attention to the public data. They pay attention to BLS. You can see when number comes out 8:30 on the first Friday after the first Thursday of the month, you almost know which way the market's gonna go. All right, they trust it over decades and decades. But if they put untrustworthy shit out, these big hedge funds and stuff, they got their own research and they'll put it out.
These big hedge funds aren't going to determine Social Security benefits, James.
No,
that's a pretty big deal.
I agree, but it's horrible. I'm not at all suggesting to you that it's not horrible. And you know, they're going to tinker with the inflation number. They're going to try to. But the more that people, the more that private data that comes out that contradicts it, the less effective it is. I guess that's what I'm saying. But no, it's beyond horrible.
Yeah.
You can't imagine how bad it is.
Well, what it is, James, is if it's like, you know, you go to a doctor and that doctor says, you know, you're kind of in trouble. You have Parkinson's, maybe even cancer. And you say, well, let's get rid of that doctor. God damn it. I don't like that result. Let's go find a doctor who's going to give me good news. If you do that, you're stupid. And what Trump is doing is stupid. And I fear it's going to have some harm.
What he's doing is trying to cling to every shred of power he can possibly cling to.
Right.
And he doesn't care if it's the data is wrong or whatever. But he doesn't even think like that. And, you know, well, we'll talk about it some more.
I'll tell you one thing, just a final note on the Washington, D.C. thing. One thing that I think is underscores that the person who should be championing the district in Congress is Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is 88 years old. She's out of it. She doesn't belong there. It's just like Dianne Feinstein was, and it's just like I think Chuck Grassley is being run by staff. I would not vote for an age limit, but God damn it, people who are beyond the pale ought to get the hell out.
God damn, Mendeley's been there since I can remember. Jesus. I agree with you. I'm not for an age limit, but man, I think these younger people, I mean, even though we're too old guys, I mean, somebody, you know, give Nancy Pelosi some credit. I mean, you know, she took it right to where she had to, and then she had the good sense and the grace and the dignity to leave. You know, I got to say that Virginia and New Jersey, these are not elections. Okay. You're not really, of course, you're voting for a governor. Of course, you got to live with what you have. You know, and I would argue very persuasively, I think, that the two candidates that we're Democratic Party is offered in both states are uniquely qualified, uniquely fit the time, fit the job, fit the moment. But this is not just an election, let you go. It's a SOS signal to the country. It's like, okay, if we win Virginia by 5.5 points, I'm going to be disappointed. And should never say that in politics. A win is a win. You know, come on, man. It doesn't matter. You know, all you do is you have the governor. You can implement, and that's great. And I think she'll be a great governor. But we got to romp and stomp and run up the score. People that listen to this podcast, you'd send money to the state party or volunteer or call people, and you're going to win. That's not what we're not talking about winning the Virginia governorship. We're talking about sending a SOS sign. You know, when John Hancock signed the Declaration of Independence, his famous hand, he wanted the king to be able to read it without his glasses. All right. You're John Hancock.
You don't think he had me in mind?
I'm telling you, whatever you do, these elections are critical, and they're not just an election to elect a governor. It's a SOS to the entire country. Oh my God, we're sinking. Somebody do something. And I you know what? I think we're going to get it done. I'm preaching the Virginia and New Jersey gospel between now and November of this year, because it's got to be so big that you get these assholes and you see, Trump's moving the country and the young non-white males are moving against the party and the this and the that and the technical stuff and the regression analysis. You got to make this thing so fucking big you knock them out of their jackass chairs.
I'll take 2 double-digit wins. You will too. You want more, but you'll take that.
I take it, but I want more. When it comes,
James, when it comes to winning important races, you've always been greedy.
This is not just an important race. It's not like we had Chris Christie for 8 years in New Jersey. I think would have been better off with a Democratic governor. We had McDowell 4 years in Virginia. We just had Youngkin for 4 years. I mean, I I certainly think we cut back on things that we shouldn't, and, you know, we didn't do like a lot of stuff that I wish. But, you know, Virginia's still there, New Jersey's still there. If we don't do this, the United States might not still be there. All right? That's the difference. With every election, we drive up the stakes, we talk about its importance. I think they are important. This is like the first chance that the American people have to send out a SOS message. And it has to be clear, it has to be crisp, it has to be loud, and it has to be decisive. And, of course, supposed to come back, we win Virginia by 4.5, we win New Jersey by 1.5. Somebody's going to say, well, Carville, you'll run your goddamn mouth back in August, and look how well the Republicans did. They'll have a point.
Yeah.
They'll have a point. And you know, you can say something like, well, you know, we won the election, that's what counts. We now have continued Democratic rule in New Jersey, and we now have a Democratic governor in Virginia, and lives will be better, but it ain't going to save the country. That 4.5 in Virginia and 1.5 in New Jersey, it's not going to save the country. In fact, probably put it more in reverse.
83 days to go. Big, big November 5.
Big.
Okay.
Really big. Person that's on the other side of you, the other consultant, the other lawyer, the other journalist, the other senator, the other staff person, if they're in good shape and you're not, that's not going to be good for your future. So you want to be able to work hard, stay up at night, do the necessary socializing, and intermingle your business. And when you go to work the next morning, you want to be on top of the game. When you and I were coming up, it was a choice we had to make. Maybe more often than not, we took the choice and we just try to gut through it and be less effective the next morning. Now you don't even have to make that choice. Science has come to your rescue. We're glad to have it. So you can stay out. You can actually have an extra drink. You can take this and you're raring to go in the morning.
Well, I don't drink as much as I used to, but I still will have a drink or two. And bouncing back, I also don't bounce back the way I used to. So, you know, it used to be a big decision. Do you want to have a great night or a great next day? Luckily, with pre-alcohol, you don't have to compromise. To fill you in, ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's the buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that is to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme that breaks this byproduct down. Just remember, to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night, then drink responsibly, and you're going to feel your best the next day. Now, thanks to ZBiotics, James can even go on long runs after his long nights. Every time you have a ZBiotics pre-alcohol before a drink, it makes a big difference, whether you're writing all day, exercising, or even going out in front of an audience. ZBiotics is the MVP when it counts. The final days of summer are here for you to enjoy. Whether you're headed to the beach, camping in the woods, or squeezing in one last vacation road trip, don't forget to bring ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. Drink a pre-alcohol before drinking and enjoy every day of summer to the fullest. So go to zbiotics.com/PWR to learn more and get 15% off your first order. When you use the code PWR at checkout, ZBiotics is back with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. But remember, head to zbiotics.com/PWR and use the code PWR at checkout for 15% off. The link also is in our show notes.
Start your day right with ZBiotics.
This week marks the 80th anniversary of the Japanese surrender in the Pacific to end World War II. There is no greater expert than one of our very favorite guests, Craig Simons, legendary Naval Academy historian, former head of the History Department, author of dozens of books about naval campaigns, a biography of Admiral Chester Nimitz. We are so pleased that you can be on today. Craig, I can't tell you. Let me go back to a question that we have discussed before on this day, and that is that there are still debates about how the war ended in the Pacific. Some argue with a more aggressive diplomacy, we could have forged a peace agreement earlier with Japan. Others say, it was the entry of the Soviet Union in the war against Japan, and many believe it was only the horror of dropping the nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that caused the Japanese to surrender and avoid an invasion that would have caused hundreds of thousands of lives. Where does the professor come down?
The professor comes down on the side that however horrific it was, I think some sort of extra-worldly deus ex machina, the hand of God reaching down and smiting the Japanese Empire, was necessary to convince the Japanese that their culture of surrender is the most dishonorable thing on earth. It's better to die than surrender. There were Japanese leaders who argued 100 million dead Japanese is better than abject surrender. So to break through that cultural wall, some outside, exterior, extra-worldly event was necessary. Now, I do think it is true, as, for example, Chester Nimitz and his boss, Ernest J. King, argued, that a prolongation of the virtual blockade of Japan by American submarines, which allowed almost nothing to get through, including food, and continual bombing of Japanese cities conventionally, would have just wrecked Japanese society. And the question that arises is, how long would that have had to go on? With 5 million killed, 10 million, 20 million. So the alternatives to the deployment of the atomic bomb really look no more humane than using the bomb itself. And the bomb had the advantage of cracking that cultural opposition to the very idea of capitulation. So the professor comes down on the side of Truman.
I'm true.
That using the bombs was the right thing to do, the only thing to do.
It's also, I think, one good thing that it's been, 80 years, and there are now 9 or 10 countries that have the bomb, and it's never been used since then. And I think the horror of Nagasaki and Hiroshima has sunk in. That's not to say don't live in perilous times, but that is an important lesson to be learned from that.
I think it is, and I think that the heart-wrenching and hand-wringing writings that came out of the use of the bomb, particularly by John Hersey on his book Hiroshima, which got widely read because it was relatively short and so eviscerating, helped people appreciate this is not just a bigger bomb. This is something else entirely. And that idea of conventional war versus nuclear war. It didn't exist in 1945. I mean, we had 500-pound bombs. We had 1,000-pound bombs. The British had a 4,000-pound bomb. We now have 30,000-pound bunker buster bombs. They're all called conventional because they aren't nuclear. But in 1945, the idea was, this is just a bigger bomb, isn't it? And I think the world has now come to draw a fairly bright line between conventional war and nuclear war. And so far, and I'm touching wood as I say this, no one has crossed that line.
Well, Craig, the scene was actually set before August by Iwo Jima and Okinawa, which I think 20,000 Allied forces killed, another 50 or 1,000 more casualties. What was the import of those bloody battles leading up to decisions that were made the next month?
Yeah, I think they did have an impact. I think the entire war, really, from Guadalcanal on, had an impact. Americans and Japanese really did not understand each other in terms of their cultural values. I mean, the Japanese, for example, thought that bombing the American fleet at Pearl Harbor, the Americans would say, oh my goodness, we didn't realize how serious you were about this. We'd better sit down with you and negotiate. Well, that, of course, is an absurd assumption. The Americans thought that cutting off oil, what we would call economic sanctions today, but which the Japanese saw as blackmail, would convince the Japanese to withdraw from Indochina. Neither of those things were going to happen. And I think those are just obvious examples of the kind of cultural disconnect between the two sides. So when the war across the Pacific began, first on Guadalcanal, where the Japanese demonstrated that they were willing to squander the lives of their soldiers in previously unimaginable numbers in order to achieve a tactical advantage, the Americans shook their heads in misunderstanding how could that be possible. And so, of course, then subsequently, the Tarawa, Kwajalein, Ujima, Okinawa, Saipan, all of those campaigns demonstrated to Americans just how difficult it would be to defeat the Japanese in their home islands if an invasion became necessary.
Craig, we just returned from an inspiring trip to Normandy, and you've written about the Normandy campaign, the naval campaign there also. But the Marines were basically shut out of the Normandy invasion. There's a bit of a rivalry between the Army and the Marines, mildly. Both fought valiantly in the Pacific. Was there any qualitative difference?
Well, by 1945, there may have been. Remember that an awful lot of the number of soldiers who were thrown onto the beaches at Normandy had, many of them did have prior campaigns in Italy and Sicily, but a lot of them did not. The Marines in the Pacific learned lessons at places like Tarawa, which was a terrible bloodbath, losing 1,000 killed and 3,000 wounded on an island smaller than 1 square mile. But they got better at it as time went on. So by 1945, I think an argument could be made that in terms of conducting an amphibious landing, the Marines were blooded and experienced in doing so, and many of the soldiers were not. But in terms of pure grit, toughness, determination, willingness, I don't see any difference between the two.
Yeah. Churchill was asked, when did he realize or when did he think that the Allies were going to win the war? And he said December 7th, 1941. He said, once the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and America got in full force, we knew that how the war would end. We didn't know when, we didn't know how many people would die, we didn't know a lot of things, but that sealed, that really sealed the fate. For all of the extraordinary battles in the Pacific, Midway, Guadalcanal, the Solomon Islands, the ones we just talked about, were the Japanese really doomed, as far as victory, were they really doomed from the beginning?
Oh, I think so. The Japanese view of how this war would play out is that they would punch the United States in the nose. They would take out the offensive capability of the American battle fleet on the first day of the war. And then that would give them 6 months during which they would build up their defenses, they would occupy islands, put fortifications on those islands, and then the Americans would try to fight their way across the Pacific. Remember, the Japanese never had any concept that they would win the war the way Americans define winning the war. That is going to the enemy's capital and taking it and hanging the enemy opponent. What the Japanese envisioned was that in a year, 2 years, 3 years, those movie-going, hamburger-eating, car-driving Americans would say, oh my gosh, this is too hard, it's too difficult, it's too expensive, it's too costly, let's talk. And that would be the moment of what the Japanese would perceive as victory. They would be able to keep most of what they had conquered in South Asia. Remember, the goal of the Japanese is not anything the Americans have. It's what the Dutch and the British and the French have. They wanted those resource-rich islands of the South Pacific, what is now Indonesia and then Indochina, now, of course, Vietnam, Malaya, now Siam and Malaysia. they were rich in oil and coal and iron and tin and all the things the Japanese didn't have. So that was their goal. That's what they wanted out of the war. And the reason they went to war with the United States was because to get all those raw materials from the South Pacific to Japan, Japanese transport ships and tankers would have to pass right by the American-held Philippines. Well, that left the Americans in a position, you see, to have their hand on the valve that controlled the flow of oil to Japan. So to stop that, we'll have to take the Philippines too. And that does mean war with the United States. So we'll attack Pearl Harbor. Now, it's a roundabout set of logic, but I mentioned earlier the logic applied by the two sides is not always congruent. Right.
I mentioned that we had just gotten back from Normandy. You wrote a marvelous biography several years ago of Admiral Chester Nimitz, the commander of the Pacific Fleet during the war. He was, you know, really competent. He was smart. He was a man who was able to work with all sorts of people, a real leader in that sense, and surrounded by others who, shall we say, had less of those qualities, Douglas MacArthur, Bull Halsey. He really struck me as there are parallels to Eisenhower.
Yes, quite a few. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think they are really the same type of commander in terms of temperament. What made Eisenhower a great commander and deserving of all the accolades he's been granted over the years by historians was not that he led troops in battle. You know, he never did. He missed out entirely. It's class of 1915, I believe.
Yes.
And he never got into World War I. He stayed home and trained tank drivers in Gettysburg, but he never got into the war, to his great disappointment. He spent much of the interwar year as, of all things, an aide to Douglas MacArthur. And boy, that will test your patience. And then he never led troops in battle, because by the time the Second World War broke out, he was already a brigadier general and on the planning staff for George Marshall. So here's a guy who never led troops in combat, and yet arguably was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, generals in American history. And why? And my answer is, and always has been, temperament. I think that he had the kind of steady, intellectually based temperament that allowed him to listen carefully, to analyze thoughtfully, make decisions, explain the decisions to his subordinates, coordinate the actions that came out of his decisions, and make things happen. So people that we tend to think of as warrior types, and you mentioned several of them, MacArthur thought of himself as a warrior, certainly. He did engage in combat in both world wars. Patton is an obvious example. You want guys like that on your side in a war, for sure, but you probably don't want them running the show. Because they're more likely to go off half-cocked. They're less likely to take into full consideration all the elements of a complex campaign, and there weren't any campaigns more complex than D-Day. So I think that Nimitz and Eisenhower shared that temperament, that calmness, that appearance of nothing ruffled them. I mean, you hardly ever hear of either one of them pounding his fist, shouting at his subordinates. That's simply not the way they operated. And I think that there's a lot in common between those two.
You know, that famous picture of Eisenhower talking to, I guess it was the 101st, the night before D-Day. And, you know, what was it about? How tense was it? They were talking about fishing in Michigan.
Right.
Which is, I think, goes to your point. I don't think Patton would have been talking about fishing in Michigan if he had been in that.
No, we know we have transcripts of the kinds of things Patton tended to talk to the troops about, and fishing is not in the index.
One advantage I think that Ike had over Nimitz was his superior officer was George C. Marshall, whereas Nimitz had Ernest King, who was not an easy man to get along with.
That's absolutely true. King, one of the more interesting personalities in the entire Second World War. King was efficient, hardworking. Probably no one worked harder than he did during the entire war. But he would not suffer fools, or anybody else for that matter, either gladly or otherwise. He said exactly what he thought when he thought it. He drove the British crazy. He drove everyone under him crazy. He drove the army crazy. But again, Nimitz, having the kind of temperament that Eisenhower did, was able, I don't want to say manage him, that sounds dismissive in some way, but was able to understand when he had to fight a battle and when there were battles that he was not going to win anyway. So I will simply find ways around this. That relationship between King and Nimitz is a particularly interesting one. And you mentioned George C. Marshall, who's often an unsung hero or undersung, if that's a word, hero of the Second World War, because FDR had promised him many times that when D-Day occurred, that George Marshall would command it. And of course, when the time came, FDR told him, I could not sleep at night if I didn't know that you were here at my side to advise me. So I need you here in Washington, and we'll give the command to somebody else. And of course, that turned out to be Marshall's deputy, Eisenhower. And Marshall and Eisenhower had a very close relationship. And one of the clever things that Eisenhower did was he wrote to Marshall regularly, not just reports. I mean, a lot of people write reports because you have to write reports. They're due on such and such a date. But Eisenhower knew Marshall wanted to be in on the planning, the thinking, the action of the war, and wrote him regularly, long, informative letters. They're all in the Eisenhower papers, which is great for historians because it gives us insight not only into what was happening, but what Eisenhower and Marshall were thinking about what was happening. So I think both Nimitz and Eisenhower treated their superiors, both King and Marshall, in ways that were necessary to allow them to thrive. Now, they treated them very differently, of course, because they were different personalities, but they were both quite thoughtful about it.
Well, these two calm men, when it mattered, were very bold. Eisenhower, obviously, with Operation Overlord, but Nimitz at Midway. I mean, that was a critical. Why am I telling Craig Simons this? I think you would agree. That was a critical turning point, something that America needed in 1942 after Pearl Harbor. And Nimitz really was, he was the strategist, and it was a bold strategy.
It was. We have to remember that even before the United States got into the war, the high commands of both countries, Britain and America, got together in Washington and crafted what would be a coordinated strategy if the United States got into the war. And they decided that the answer was, we have to defeat Germany first. Germany is by far the more dangerous enemy. Its gross domestic product is four times that of Japan. Japan is troublesome and problematic, and their navy is very good, and they're tough fighters. But we can deal with them after the defeat of Germany. And both sides sign on to this. So the idea that Germany is the real enemy leaves Nimitz with a mandate of saying, well, my job is just to kind of hang out here, to hang on, to make sure the Japanese don't conquer all of the Pacific islands. I should stay on the defensive until perhaps 1943, maybe even 1944, by which time the new construction warships of the Vincent Tramalac will become available. Germany may or may not be defeated or on the way to defeat, and then I can begin an offensive. So one option for him when he learned through the codebreakers, and we can talk about them if you like, but when Nimitz learned that the Japanese were coming to Midway with four aircraft carriers, two battleships, and a total of 150 warships altogether, although not operating together, one option for him was to say, Midway, those two tiny little islands out in the middle of the Pacific, help yourself. I am not going to risk my three carriers, really only two and a half, because one of them was badly crippled from the Battle of the Coral Sea. I am not going to risk my carriers against this superior force. I'm going to hoard my resources until maybe next year, maybe the year after, I can go on the offensive. But he did not do that. The way he calculated it was, I can patch up my crippled aircraft carrier. I've got an airstrip on Midway. That gives me four landing strips for my aircraft. They're coming with four aircraft carriers. Sounds like an even match to me, and I know they're coming. So, but not, even so, I mean, that's logical, in hindsight especially. But at the time, that's high risk, and he had to sell it to Washington.
Well, you mentioned the code breaker, so go ahead.
Well, there's two things I want to say about that. First of all, they were absolutely essential. But also, there's been a tendency in the last 50 years, I won't say 80 years, because the role that they played in the war is kept confidential, top secret, actually, for a generation before in the 1970s, it became known that they had played such a big role. And from that time, there's been a tendency to think, well, no wonder we won. We were reading their mail. Now, that's not true either, because what the codebreakers did with a lot of hard work and a lot of intense scalp scratching and computer usage and comparing Japanese notes one from another, were able to winkle out of the Japanese radio traffic just enough information to give them a hint of what the Japanese were likely to be up to. And that's what Joe Rochefort, who ruled this small group of semi-eccentric basement-dwelling codebreakers, brought to Nimitz's intelligence chiefs and said, this is what we think. And Nimitz trusted them. Nimitz actually asked Joe Rochefort to come into his office and brief him personally on what he knew, what he thought, what he suspected, and then Nimitz had to react to that. And as I say, a more cautious commander would have said, well, we really don't know this, right? We just think this is likely. But Nimitz acted.
Famously or infamously, the Chicago Tribune reported that we had broken the Japanese code at or right after Midway. How big a deal was that?
Well, it turned out not to be a big deal, but could very well have been a big deal. It was a front page story, but it was a one column heading, so it was not a giant headline. This reporter had been on a ship that had access to the fact that we knew something about what the Japanese were doing that had been left out on the wardroom table. And he read that. His name was Johnson, and wrote up a story. And after the battle was over, reported that one of the reasons the Allies won the Battle of Midway was because they had been reading Japanese messages. Well, King wanted him arrested and shot. I mean, he was absolutely furious. Yeah. But the calmer head said, well, you know, if you arrest him and shoot him, the Japanese will know he was right. If we just ignore it, maybe they won't pay attention.
Because fortunately, no one in Tokyo read the Chicago Tribune about it.
No one was reading the Chicago Tribune that day. That's right.
Yeah. I think Roosevelt wanted to behead him also, but it's just, Craig, let me ask you one final question. You are retired officially as a professor at the Naval Academy. So I want to ask you a question about the Academy these days. There seems to me to be a lot of churning going on. The first woman superintendent, Vice Admiral Yvette Davis, was replaced, other women officers elsewhere. Almost 400 books were banned from authors like Maya Angelou and Harper Lee. Most have been returned. But have you seen this kind of turmoil before at the Academy?
Absolutely not. It's completely unprecedented and completely unnecessary. There is a view existing in the minds of some that civilians, any civilian, are a bunch of weeny, woke, communist, dope-smoking, I don't know what the view is. But the notion is if we can just get rid of all these civilians and make sure that everybody who teaches at the Naval Academy is somebody who can do 100 push-ups, that will improve the warfighting capability of the students we graduate. I think all of that is wrong. I taught at the Naval Academy for 30 years. I've never worked with a more dedicated or seen a more dedicated group of scholars who are committed to the role of the institution than the civilian professors in the history department at the Naval Academy. All wonderful people. And if we ask students occasionally to think for themselves, that to me is a good thing. So all of this just breaks my heart, to be honest. I thought when I was teaching there that I was teaching at arguably the greatest undergraduate institution in the country because it combined really good faculty with extraordinary young men and women and the discipline that came from Bancroft Hall. It's a heady mix. The students were committed, intelligent, thoughtful, dedicated, hardworking. We asked a lot of them, and they produced a lot. And I'm afraid that's going to go away. I don't know what I would say to a young man or woman today seeking an education at the Naval Academy. I might suggest you'd be better off going to a civilian university and joining NROTC to get your commission, because then you can be sure of getting an education. I'm just not sure where this, you called it turmoil and churn. I think it's a lot worse than that.
Oh, that's frightening, Craig. That's absolutely frightening. I tell you, it's another reason we miss John McCain. I don't think that he would have tolerated that. I think he would have made Hegseth and the others, the Navy Secretary, he really would have put them on the firing line on this. But I hope you're wrong about what you said, as I know you do. But in any event, Craig Simons, you've been a great guest, and your latest book is Annapolis Goes to War, a history of the Naval Academy class of 1940 that was graduating just before the Great War started, and many of them were at Pearl Harbor a year and a half later. So Annapolis Goes to War with the best naval historian of all times, Craig Simons. Thank you.
Thank you, Al. I appreciate it.
I got to tell you, the temperature around you really determines a big factor in how much good sleep you get. And there's no temperature around you that's any more closer to you or more intimate than your sheets. So why wouldn't you take, that's the first line in a program to get a good night's sleep. So take advantage of it. That's the easy one. That's the easy one. You're assured of having cool, comfortable surroundings. And you just can't beat it. And it's right next to you. How can you beat it?
You can't. Because sleeping at the right temperature is a critical way to feel rested the next day. Now, if you wake up too hot or too cold, we highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Plus, the silver lining prevents 99.7% of bacterial growth, which means Miracle Sheets require three times less laundry because they stay clean and fresh three times longer. Stop sleeping on bacteria that can clog your pores and cause breakouts and acne. Sleep clean with Miracle instead. Trust us, with no more gross odors, life is a whole lot better for your household. The NASA-inspired, temperature-regulating, silver-infused fabrics truly give you maximum comfort in any weather, and they make pillowcases and comforters also. So join us in getting better sleep every night. Not only are Miracle Sheets luxuriously comfortable, they don't have the high price tag of other luxury brands. Miracle Sheets feel nicer than bed sheets used by some five-star hotels. So it's a vacation when you get in bed. Don't wake up in a pool of sweat. Upgrade your sleep as the weather heats up. Go to trymiracle.com/war room to try Miracle Made Sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40% off. And if you use our promo, War Room, at checkout, you'll get a free three-piece towel set and save an extra 20%. Now, Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/war room and use the code War Room to claim your free three-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/war room to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Also, look for the link in our show notes.
Sleep clean and comfortable with Miracle.
Washington is a consummate political town, and divisions and polarizations, while worse today, aren't new. However, some institutions transcended this and elevated not just the culture, but the comity of the city. Foremost is the Kennedy Center and also the Smithsonian Museum. Trump already has meddled and debased the Kennedy Center, even talking about renaming it the Trump Center. Of the many great moments and performances that this center has shown every year, the highlight has been the Honors Program, for years brilliantly directed by George Stevens Jr., recognizing America's great artists every year. Trump now wants to make the Honors Evening conform to his ideology. So one of his first selections was Sylvester Stallone. Now he has his sights on debasing the Smithsonian, a national treasure, ordering a review of the exhibits that reflect the history of his liking. We know what that history will look like. It's amazing, James. I'm not sure we can find an institution that he hasn't in some way hurt or desecrated.
Of course, and I was like anything I got to think about, Ray, you know, you give it a lot of thought. And, I think David Kirkpatrick and some really good journalists figured out that, but we know he's made $3.5 billion since he's been elected, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That, all right. Well, that's a real outrage. I mean, it's never happened anything like remotely close to that. They had a meeting in the White House with the Deputy Attorney General, the FBI, the Susie, Chief of Staff of the White House, to try to figure out what to do about the Epstein case. I mean, that normally that would be the outrage of outrage. It would be screaming headlines. I regress to say in Phoenix, Arizona, when Bill Clinton met with Loretta Lynch, the then Attorney General, for 10 minutes on an airplane with FBI and Secret Service agent presence. Everybody had a meltdown. This happened, and people commented on it. Again, I don't know. Now you have occupying troops in the capital city. The deficit for the month of July alone was something like $271 billion in 1 month. Any one of these things would be off the chart outrageous. Collectively, I that's the sort of problem that we face with. There's so much, and it's so hard to pick out. And I guess to some extent, that's what they're counting on. But it's just going to get increasingly worse. No one thinks that this is stuff. You know, we would talk about, oh, it's going to be so bad. It's going to be awful. We can't imagine. And we kind of thought that we could not imagine. In my wildest dreams, I would never project that he would occupy a city with a significantly declining crime rate. You just couldn't imagine. There are Laura Loomer attacking a Medal of Honor winner. Who in the world would attack a Medal of Honor winner? Oh, Laura Loomer would. And the kind of back and forth between her and Martin Dale Green. I mean, these people don't have any shame. They don't have any pride. They don't have anything. It's just all, and to call them trailer trash, there are a lot of people that live in trailers that lead honorable lives. I mean, let's be honest here. A lot of people try to pay their bills. A lot of people do this. It's beyond anything that we can pick out. The scope of it is so horrendous. I'm overwhelmed by it. And all I can say, people, is please, Virginia, please, New Jersey, send that SOS signal out. Send it out in the clear. Send it loud. Let everybody hear it. It's critical, but the truth of the matter is, until this product came, that was the luxury of a fluid people. that could pay attorneys, financial advisors, you know, they could set up things. And this was not something that semi-affluent or ordinary people had access to. What this product does, it's going to give you the same level that you're going to get if you go to, like, a big law firm. I mean, they're very competent people. It's accessible, it's affordable, and your affairs are going to be in damn good order. And you're going to be able to leave your loved one something that they can have and cherish and use. And it's really a very egalitarian thing that we're able to bring this kind of estate planning, if you will, to the masses.
Yeah, it sure is. Because, you know, look, James, I hate to say it, a lot of us aren't spring chickens, and we want to be ready for any eventuality. No matter what age you are, it's critical to be prepared. So we have to sound the alarm. A lot of us don't realize that a will doesn't cover everything when it comes to estate planning. Thankfully, Trust and Will can help ensure that your loved ones are covered when it comes to things like medical decisions and power of attorney when it matters most. Don't wait to start getting prepared. Go to trustandwill.com/warroom to get 20% off their simple, secure, and expert-backed estate planning services. By now, you may have realized that James and I aren't exactly tech experts. I think that's fair to say, James. But no matter what your skill level, the website is super easy to navigate. That means you can quickly find out about how Trust and Will can help you make sure your assets and future wishes are secure. I know I want my family to be ready for any eventuality, and our young producer has said he got his dad signed up as soon as he heard about Trust and Will. Wow. He says it's not about the money. Well, they always say it's not about the money, but he says it's not about the money. It's about being prepared. Maybe, maybe not. But I know that Trust and Will can ensure that the future of what you've built in your hands is the ultimate peace of mind. Their easy-to-use website is simple to navigate with all of your information and documents securely stored with bank-level encryption. Best of all, they make your plans their top priority. Each will and trust is state-specific, legally valid, and customized to your needs. It's no surprise that they have an overall rating of excellent on Trustpilot with thousands of five-star reviews. So don't wait. Join the hundreds of thousands of families using Trust and Will. After all, we can't control everything, but Trust and Will can help you take control of protecting your family's future. Go to trustandwill.com/warroom for 20% off. That's 20% off at trustandwill.com/warroom. The link is in our show notes.
Protect your legacy with Trust and Will.
Okay, and now questions from our listeners. Great ones as always. And by the way, if we didn't get to yours this week, send it again because we may well get to it next week. James, the first question is from Wes in Athens, Georgia, home of the Bulldogs.
Yeah.
He said, last week's show, you said Kamala Harris should not run again because people want to turn the page. How is her running again any different than Donald Trump running after he was defeated?
I think people want to turn the page from him. I mean, she served as Attorney General of the largest state. She served in the United States Senate, representing the largest state. She was Vice President of the United States. She was the presidential nominee in 2024. My sense is, I'm sorry, I think people will be looking. I don't think anybody that had anything to do with 2024 is going to be who the Democrats want around in 2028. That's what I really believe. She's had a distinguished career in American politics, but 2028 is not her year.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I read a story the other day that the Biden people are putting out the word warning her, don't you dare criticize Joe Biden or we'll come after you. Don't those people realize nobody cares? They are yesterday. They are gone.
Sorry.
Oh, Jesus.
I mean, come on. Look, again, 30 years in the United States Senate, you chair judiciary, you chair foreign relations, yeah. You might be the most accomplished people post-World War II America that maybe there is. You were vice president for 8 years. You were president for 4 years. For God's sakes, man, just enjoy your well-deserved rest.
No question. James, we're going globally today. Tom in Toronto says Trump is moving the military to D.C. Is this another distraction from Epstein, which we have discussed, or preparation to defend against an insurrection? Tom, I think that if Trump doesn't get his way with gerrymandering, he will in Texas, but if he can't thwart California gerrymandering really does matter a great deal. And if he can't thwart that, and it looks like he's going to lose the House, I don't think it's far-fetched at all to think he is going to use the term insurrection and call off the election. Would I bet on that happening? No. But do I think it's remote? No.
I think it's more so. This is what I hope happens. This is realistic. This could happen. Virginia and New Jersey fulfill our wildest dreams. They turn into where you just the margin becomes it's just undeniable. He feels that, and of course, I'm gonna take a little time here. When that happens, then the image of the Democratic Party. It's going to start to go up. Why? Because other Democrats are going to see the Democrats won elections, so they're going to start feeling bad about it. Then people's attention is going to turn to 2026. And everybody that we want to recruit, we're getting now. Sherrod Brown says he is going to run in Ohio. I can't tell you how significant a decision that is. That a guy that age, and it certainly seems like Governor Janet Mills is leaning toward running in Maine. The point is, all of the things that you want to happen for us in 2026 are starting to happen. You're going to start to see things for them that are not going to happen. He is going to see a massive 26 coming. And when I tell you that I don't really think the Senate is anywhere close to being out of reach, I don't want to assign a 50-50 or 45-55 number to it because it's senseless. But I think it's going to become eminently clear they can't gerrymander their way out. It's going to be a significant House Democratic majority. It's going to be increasingly likely that the Democrats get the Senate back. And if you think of the crazy shit he's doing now, just imagine a year from now. Just imagine. And the Democrats need to set up like Walter and Seth and Don Varelli and all did, and they set up a whole legal team in anticipating for the election fight after the 2020 election. They have to set up a highly skilled legal communications team. Need to get ready to put stuff out. Because this son of a bitch, it is a likely scenario that they get slaughtered beyond comprehension in Virginia and New Jersey. The polling goes totally south on the coming midterms. And if you think what they're doing now is something, wait till you see what they're getting ready to do. And you cannot sound the alarm loud enough. You can't talk about it too much. You can't even imagine it's going to take preparation because the electoral slaughter, I think, is coming. And he is not going to sit there and not try something to keep from getting like utterly humiliated. And that's what's getting ready to happen to him.
Henry in New Orleans, good question, says, isn't it time for the Democratic establishment to rally behind Mondami in New York to be able to share the credit for his win rather than sit on the sidelines creating the false narrative that the socialists have taken over the party?
Well, first of all, my friend, I have no fucking idea what the Democratic establishment is. Okay, I understand. It's
Yeah, but you know what he's talking about. I mean, it may not be the establishment.
I kind of do. The Schumann, but I kind of do. The guy's going to win. And I think that the smarter thing to do, I mean, and he's the only one that's offering anything, by the way. The Andrew and Eric Adams, I mean, and by the way, did you see that the Curtis, how you pronounce his name? The guy's been around, a guardian angel. He's a Republican. He doesn't even want Trump's nomination. He doesn't want Trump's endorsement. The guy at the Republican in New York, guardian angel guy, he's been in the news, sort of, shit, I don't know, last 35 years. But Madonna's going to win. He's going to make, the courts are going to try to blow him up into something else. But I got to tell you, the guy's got skill. And, life in New York, I'm here right now, coming in, I was just looking at, like, the transit trains and people getting in. And life is hard, and the guy is talking about things that really matter to people. And most people think he's actually going to carry the Jewish vote. I have no idea. I'm just telling you, people tell me. I don't know if it's necessary for, I don't think the Democratic establishment getting behind him is, if anything, wouldn't help him at all. Maybe they ought to just keep their distance and let the guy win and show if he can govern. But
I'll tell you one thing that would help him, and that is if Trump comes out against him.
Oh, yeah.
I think the one person who wants Trump involved in New York is Mandava.
Good. And the Republican nominee doesn't even want Trump involved.
Right. He's a guy.
Of course, he can't help it because he can raise money off of it, and he can gas up the people at Fox or anything else. Do I agree with everything he said in his 20s? Shit, no, I don't agree with everything I said in my own 20s. But Don has shown himself to be a politician you always knew he was kind of smart, but he's kind of disciplined and to the point. Yeah. And, our Democrats have people in that are more aggressively pro-change than a lot of other people. Yeah, but I'm glad we have those, because you don't have reactionaries.
Okay, Pete in Raleigh, North Carolina, says, Dr. Phil said on Bill Maher's show that ICE agents have to wear masks because they and their families are being targeted. What do you think of that argument? I guess by that logic, police ought to wear a mask, right? Everybody ought to wear a mask. I'm sure there's some cases where it might be justified. Because I'm sure some of these are good people, but I think it has more to do with the thuggery mindset that Hohen and others have brought to these ICE operations.
It seemed to be had a really kind of soothing TV personality. I think it was a creation of Oprah Winfrey, actually. And his flirtation and fooling around on the right, I don't think it's very smart for him professionally. And it doesn't fit in, but I watch the show a lot. It was on there, but I watch it. Local news, I'd watch the lead in. And he seems to be, or was, a man of some charm. And this is what you're going to be remembered for. I don't know, just the most successful TV psychologist. I don't have no idea. But why are you doing this to your legacy, to your reputation? I don't get what motivates these people. I really don't.
I'm less enamored with his past, but certainly not enamored with what he is now.
Seemed like a kind of soothing guy. He had a good shtick.
He was a little quackish, but
okay.
Cameron in Brisbane, Australia. We're going down under now, James. He said, is there any way for a U.S. opposition party to select something akin to an interim leader until the next primary process, I guess he's talking about 28, elects a person to lead the party?
Well, I mean, they elect a leader of the House, you know, like the Senate Democrats elect a leader, the DNC. There's not going to be a leader of the Democratic Party in this system. There is no leader until you have a presidential nominee. That's the bad news. The bad news is we're not going to have a leader until a little less than, what is it, 2-3 years from now? But when we do, we're gonna have a good one. And in the meantime, if you become the majority and you have the speakership and you have the majority of the Senate, then you become more relevant and the leadership enhances itself. Again, I go back. I can't think past Virginia and New Jersey, and we can parlay that into something else.
Tilly in West North Carolina asks, what are thoughts on the open U.S. Senate seat in North Carolina now that incumbent Republican Tillis has announced he's not seeking re-election? It's two words, Roy Cooper. Roy Cooper is going to win that seat. Roy Cooper has won every statewide election that he's ever had. I forget whether it's 6 or 7, but he is the most successful North Carolina politician in a long time. He's running against a former party chair, sort of a dull, nondescript guy. The only chance the Republicans would have would be if it were a big GOP year. It's not going to be that. Cooper's a great candidate. He's going to win.
But yeah, we're going to win North Carolina. If it comes down to North Carolina, I think we're going to win Maine. And out of Ohio, Iowa, Texas, Mississippi, Florida, Alaska. Alaska, we got to pick up too. And I every day that I see, wouldn't say if the election were held today, we'd do that. But the way I see things going, I think we're going to pick up. We're going to have a majority in the Senate.
Well, you got to do that, James, but you also have to defend Georgia, Michigan, Minnesota, which I think is very doable. But one or two of those might be tough.
If you win Iowa, you're going to win Michigan, okay, in Minnesota. Yeah. It just doesn't. I agree. If you win North Carolina by the amount that I think that Cooper's going to win it by, you're not going to lose Georgia. They just run in tandem. Now, if it becomes a 50-50 year, if it's a 2022, which is actually a good year for Democrats, but then you kind of pick and choose. I hope right now I feel like it's not going to be a pick and choose election. I think that, I'd be a one trick pony. Virginia and New Jersey is going to tell us a lot. Well, a real lot.
Before we get to the final question, I just want our listeners to know that I guess they just announced who is going to host the Kennedy Center Honors in December. That's a job that's been done by some of the great entertainers in America, from David Letterman to some of the great Hollywood stars. This year, it is going to be hosted by, are you ready, James?
No.
Donald J. Trump.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I know CBS, I'm sorry. I ain't going to watch it that night.
I'm going to. I think he's going to make a fucking fool of himself.
Well, I can watch that the next day.
I watch it. Anyway. I don't know. But understand, it's going to get worse and worse and worse and worse.
We got one more question, James. Charlie in Scranton, Pennsylvania says, isn't the reason abortion didn't play a major role in 2024 is the different electorate in a presidential year?
The reason we lost is Democrats didn't come out and vote. Trump didn't get more votes in 2024 than he got in 2020. I was kind of surprised, after Kansas and the 2022, I think there was a real feeling that it turned out to not be the issue that Democrats thought it would be, kind of hoped it would be. And maybe people felt like if they lived in a state that they were protected and they lived in, Texas or Louisiana, it didn't matter. I don't know. But it certainly did not turn out into the issue that we thought it would be. I don't think it drove a lot of voting behavior in 24.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going to be a huge issue this time, with one very important caveat. If, as they are under pressure to do, the FDA in any way cracks down on the mailing of that abortion pill, I think that is going to energize that pro-choice group and women, and I think it will make a difference. I don't think Trump wants them to do that, but they're under a lot of pressure because the pro-life people are coming saying, hey, we delivered for you, and now we're finding that abortions are up. And so you got to do this. I don't know how he'll resolve that, but that would be a gift to Democrats.
You know, the states with the highest abortion rates, I think, are the states that outlawed. There's always been more abortions in Ireland and Italy, and Italy's never been illegal, and it's now legal in Ireland. If you want fewer abortions, I'm not sure, maybe we should get somebody on here, that outlawing is the best way to achieve that goal. I think there's a lot of evidence to the contrary. But whatever it is, it didn't turn out to be as big an issue as we thought. And that tells you something about something. I'm not sure what.
Well, one thing I will tell you is keep those questions and emails coming in. We love them. We'll get to as many as we can. And if you are disappointed we didn't get to one this week, send it again.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, ZBiotics, Miracle Made, Trust and Will. You can find them in the episode show notes. Now, we deeply thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.